Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Twelve days, 3 little letters, and back to square one. Good morning. I'm Jamie Floyd in for Brian Lehrer. It's the final day of the Copenhagen Climate Change Summit, and President Obama has joined leaders from around the world to try to rescue the talks and emerge with a comprehensive treaty. It's been 2 weeks, but little progress, as one of the emerging sticking points seems to be China's reluctance to agree to oversight. The world's biggest polluter has pledged to cut carbon, but when it comes to those three little letters, MRV, measuring, reporting, and verification, they see an affront to their sovereignty. In a minute, you'll hear from a delegate at the Copenhagen Summit for an environmental group in China that works on questions of MRV. But of course, it's not just China who's holding things up. President Obama landed in Copenhagen with no clear pledge on the part of the U.S. Congress to adopt a new climate bill. And the rift between the world's rich and poor nations continues to disrupt meetings and lead to walkouts. It's in this context that President Obama gave his address a couple of hours ago. You've been hearing the sound bites in the news, but let's walk through the substance of what the president had to say. He laid out three main pieces of the puzzle.
First, all major economies must put forward decisive national actions that will reduce their emissions and begin to turn the corner on climate change. I'm pleased that many of us have already done so. Almost all the major economies have put forward legitimate targets, significant targets, ambitious targets. And I'm confident that America will fulfill the commitments that we have made.
The president went on, without singling China out by name, to talk about the question of verification.
We must have a mechanism to review whether we are keeping our commitments and exchange this information in a transparent manner. These measures need not be intrusive or infringe upon sovereignty. They must, however, ensure that an accord is credible and that we're living up to our mutual obligations. Without such accountability, any agreement would be empty words on a page.
And finally, who's going to pay for it all?
Number three, we must have financing that helps developing countries adapt, particularly the least developed and most vulnerable countries, to climate change. America will be a part of a fast start funding that will ramp up to $10 billion by 2012.
President Obama earlier today in Copenhagen outlining his formula for climate negotiations. Let's get the latest from David Fahrenthold, environmental reporter for The Washington Post. David, welcome to WNYC.
Thank you for having me on.
Also joining us is Lucia Green-Weiskel. She's project manager at the Innovation Center for Energy and Transportation, a Chinese environmental organization based in Beijing. She's a delegate at the Copenhagen Summit and is working directly on these questions of measuring, reporting, and verification. Lucia, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
So, David, let's start with you and get the latest. There's talk of a draft political agreement circulating a couple of hours ago. Is that actually something that's being written up?
It's something that the delegates and the negotiators worked through the night on last night in Copenhagen, and it's something that I think is the best hope for some kind of agreement. Now, but we should say that if people have sort of tuned out this conference and were paying attention earlier, the first expectation for Copenhagen was it would produce sort of a successor to Kyoto. It would be some sort of grand treaty where all these countries would sign on and they would all agree to make very substantive, serious emissions reductions. This is not that. This is something else. This is something less ambitious, but it would still include some mechanism for transferring money from rich countries to poor countries to pay for adaptation to climate change. It would include some sort of measuring and verification element, and it would also basically bundle together the things that countries have already promised to do. You remember back around Thanksgiving, the U.S. and China made pledges to do sort of tackle their emissions problems. So it would bundle those things that were sort of already on the table and put that in there, too.
So then what, David, is the effect of President Obama's speech, if any? We heard him lay out those three criteria: cutting emissions, transparency, financing. Does everyone then seem to agree that those are the best criteria?
Well, I think that the effect of his speech is going to be Not that much, because his speech sort of laid out things that U.S. representatives have been saying in Copenhagen for a while and things that were already on the table. More important probably are going to be the closed-door meetings he's having with the Chinese premier, with a bunch of other leaders from the developing world and from Europe. Those are the meetings in which, you know, things that have been sticking points for a week or 2 weeks may go away. I think that the principles he laid out, there's agreement that those are the things to argue about, but I'm not sure that there's agreement that those are the things that we should, you know, that the delegates have figured out a ways to agree on.
Lucia, do you want to weigh in on this question, the impact of President Obama's speech, if any?
Well, I think for China, this issue of MRV, last night there was a major development, and the Chinese foreign minister said that they were actually shifting positions and that China would be willing to engage and consider voluntary international exchanges of information on climate programs. So up until this point, we've been hearing that China is adamantly against the idea of international inspectors coming into China and verifying their emission standards, and now there's been a shift. So I think both of these countries, the United States and China, are shifting their positions towards, I think, what they're interpreting as a compromise. If it's enough, we don't know yet. I guess we're still waiting to see.
Yeah, let's remind our listeners that you are there at the summit, Lucia. And today the Times is reporting that China cracked the door a bit on this issue. Would you, Lucia, call this a breakthrough of some sort, the equivalent of the kind of voluntary inspections that we'd want to see?
Yeah, I think it is really important. I think there's a lot. This issue of transparency hits on a very live nerve in China. There's a long history of the United States implementing policies that have sometimes other agendas to undermine the Chinese way of governing their own country. And so I think this issue of transparency is very much linked to democracy and having more open procedure of governing. And, of course, that's a very live wire in Chinese domestic politics. Today, what we heard the Minister He say is that China has its own internal systems for doing MRV, and that they should be considered reliable and sufficient.
And yet, President Obama did not single China out by name this morning. But he did say, quote, we must have a mechanism to review whether we are keeping our commitments and to exchange information in a transparent manner, in a way that will not infringe upon sovereignty. And again, that is the president's language. Will that convince Chinese leadership, in your view, Lucia?
I think we have to wait and see how the Chinese leadership responds directly to Obama's comments this morning. I'm not sure that the issue of when Obama says sovereignty, I'm not sure he's means exactly the same thing as the Chinese leadership is meaning when they use that same word. So we'll have to see.
Let me ask you one final question on this, Lucia, sort of asking you to consider the entire conference in hindsight. Of course, you planned to attend weeks ago. Did you think that your line of work on verification within China would become a major storyline of the conference?
No, actually, we didn't. I mean, I knew this was going to be very important. And certainly there's been a lot of developing attention paid to this issue of MRV. What we've been working on at the Innovation Center of Energy and Transportation is actually a voluntary system. And we had, in the last days that we were in the conference, we made a great effort to get our voice heard as an NGO that's presenting what could possibly be a compromise. Our system of MRV uses best practices, which means that we've developed our methodology based on the precedent that has been set by the Climate Registry in California, and also based on the work by the World Resources Institute and the Climate Registry and the GHG Protocol, which are being used at the highest level of government in the United States. So we have the rigorous rigor for the program,
yeah.
But we're also not an international. We don't represent an international threat. We are a local Chinese organization and can present this program or this solution on a voluntary basis, which I think could be maybe the direction that this will move in, is that there's it's not so black and white. It's not just this issue of are there going to be international inspectors or will there not be international inspectors. I think that there's a lot of different ways to verify emissions reductions, voluntary being one of them. China's own independent domestic systems is another one.
And listeners, we can take your calls on this. If you've been tracking the climate talks, it's certainly been a front page story for the better part of 2 weeks. I'm Jamie Floyd in for Brian Lehrer, and you heard our guest, David Fahrenthold, say that this won't be another Kyoto-style agreement. What is your feeling on that? 212-433-WNYC. That's 212-433-9692. And David, let me circle back to you. Earlier in the week, we heard about the rift between rich and poor countries. Let's talk a little bit about that. To what extent has that continued over the course of these meetings?
Well, to me, one of the most interesting aspects of these talks is this dynamic. People sort of portray it as rich countries against poor countries, but even within the sort of poor country camp, we're talking about a lot of countries that are actually growing very fast and powerful in their own right, places like China, India, Indonesia, Mexico, Brazil. Even within this sort of developing country camp, there were differences of opinion, different countries that wanted different things more than others. Overarching rich-poor divide was this question of funding, how much money rich countries would give to this group of developing countries to help them adapt to things like droughts, to sea level rise, to greater flooding, and that sort of it was settled in this sort of exchange of agreements where people, the U.S. and the European Union, came out with this package that eventually totaled $100 billion by 2020. And the Ethiopian prime minister, who was sort of speaking for Africa and in a larger sense speaking for the developing world, came out and said, you know, okay, we're okay with the early stages of that, which I think is, if I remember right, it's $30 billion a year by 2012. So that particular element of rich countries giving money to poor countries is solved at least at one level. Now there's a question of whether the rich countries, like the U.S., like the U.S. Senate, if what the response is going to be to this idea that money will flow out of our country to these other places that, mm-hmm. in many cases, have emissions that are going up. So that issue is settled, but there's a lot more still to talk about.
And of course, we were talking today about President Obama and his speech, but earlier in the week, Hillary Clinton, Secretary of State Clinton, was there, as you suggest, with the $100 billion a year pledge. And I guess this was intended as a bridge, right, to help bridge that divide of which we speak between rich and poor. Is that a fair way to characterize it, David?
It is. And that, I mean, to the degree that there's been any sort of progress at this conference so far, and we should note that these conferences are always cliffhangers. They never finish their work on the fifth day and go home. It's always there's always a thousand things that have to be settled, and everybody says, "Oh no, I don't know if we're going to be able to do it," right until the last moment. But the one thing that has been settled as we've gone along, the one area where there's been a lot of progress, is this question of financing. So that's one thing. But there's still the bigger questions of who cuts emissions by how much and by when. Those things, which are sort of the heart of any deal, still seem like they're floating around up in the air.
Is the major cliffhanger, though, the Chinese government? It does seem that everyone's sort of waiting to see what happens there. And David, I'll stick with you on this. And I'm thinking, of course, about President Sarkozy of France continuing to accuse China of holding up the climate talks on this reluctance. And it does get us back to verification. But that seems to be sort of the cliffhanger moment. Is that a mischaracterization by the French government, or is that really the sticking point at this moment?
You could also say China is the best negotiator here. Everybody's waiting on them to say what they'll accept. I think, yes, China in many ways is sort of the biggest obstacle. What China decides to do about this issue of verification is a big deal. Once it's settled, if it is settled, then there'll be at least be enough sort of relief and agreement that they'll be able to sign something and say we've made progress here. I think coming in, a lot of the suspense was taken out of this because we knew that the great big agreement was not coming this time. But mm-hmm. even with the lower stakes that we've settled on now, China's position now is what's holding up, I think, some settlement on those.
And yet, David, with all the focus on China, it is worth noting that the world's second biggest polluter, that would be us,
mm-hmm.
may not be pulling its weight either. You know, President Obama landed in Copenhagen without any real pledge on the part of the U.S. Congress to approve any treaty that comes out of this summit. And without our pledge, the U.S. isn't going to follow through on any agreement either, right?
Absolutely. That's not something that's adding suspense into this process now, because people know the Senate isn't going to act before the end of Copenhagen or even before the end of this year. But certainly, one of the obstacles to some sort of much greater, more ambitious agreement was this fact that the Senate hasn't acted, and the Obama administration does not want to repeat the mistakes of the Clinton administration when it signed a deal in Kyoto, came back and found that the Senate was absolutely unwilling to deal with it. So certainly that's limited the possibilities here, but it's not really factoring in this sort of suspense of this last day.
Yeah, it's interesting that we keep discussing this in terms of sort of fictional narrative with you know, cliffhangers and suspense. And storylines. But, you know, when we talk about China, there do seem to be two storylines, you know, sort of their resistance to agree to comprehensive standards and inspections. But then we hear a lot, and Lucia, I'll double back to you on this. We hear a lot about how China is such a green innovator, right? I mean, I hear this over and over again, especially when I come to Washington. I hear all the folks in Washington, environmentalists, talking about how China is trying to get ahead of the curve on green innovation, the world's biggest producer of solar panels, companies springing up every day. And take a listen to something recently said by Commerce Secretary Gary Locke.
The longer we in the United States wait, the farther ahead China will be, and it will be harder for us to catch up. If we don't get our act together, we're going to be watching the capital, the business, and the good-paying jobs end up someplace else. And some 10, 15 years from now, we're going to be saying, how did Shanghai become the Silicon Valley of clean energy?
And I recently attended a talk at the White House, Secretary Locke, an entire talk about China taking the lead on these issues. So clearly he and others believe that China in many ways is a green leader. So how do we, Lucia, reconcile these two storylines, China as the world's biggest polluter and stick in the mud at the Copenhagen talks, and China as the Silicon Valley of clean energy?
Right. Well, I can understand Secretary Locke's concern, but I think there's room for both countries to really benefit from the transition to a new green economy. The U.S. as the innovator and then China as the manufacturer. And as you said, it's true, China is the world, it's producing 40% of the world's solar panels right now. But the problem is there needs to be a transition in China from producing the green technology, the solar panels and the wind turbines that it's gotten so good at manufacturing, and they need to actually implement those or use those in their own country. So right now, most of the solar panels that are being developed in China or being manufactured in China are for export. And then the manufacturing process of those green technologies is actually very carbon intensive in and of itself. So as China is manufacturing these wind turbines and these things that are supposed to be good for the environment, its carbon footprint is growing, and then it's exporting it to Europe and the United States, which is seeing the benefits of a reduced carbon footprint by using these new technologies.
Yeah. You know, we were thinking about this story this morning, and we noticed that there's a bit of a parallel between the Copenhagen negotiations and, remarkably, the healthcare negotiations or debate, or some would call it debacle, here at home. Take a listen to something else the president said in Copenhagen this morning.
This is the bottom line. We can embrace this accord, take a substantial step forward, continue to refine it, and build upon its foundation. We can do that, and everyone who is in this room will be part of a historic endeavor, one that makes life better for our children and our grandchildren.
And there you have it, David Feringold. Either we compromise and get something done, even though it may not be what everyone or anyone really wants entirely, or we don't compromise and we get nothing done. And so in that way, maybe they're both kind of the same. What do you think, David?
Well, I think, you know, this is the sort of talk you would expect in the very last day of this conference. I think there is a lot of pressure to get something signed that people can say is progress. For everybody's sake, it looks better if there's some kind of progress made here. And it would be helpful if what looks like progress really is progress. I think the idea is if you open the door, if you get past some of the objections from the Chinese government, then that makes it easier to bring it back to the U.S. Senate, whose big sticking point has always been, well, we don't want to do something if the Chinese are going to do nothing. Then that creates a little momentum, and the idea would be that maybe you move a little closer next year to the kind of ambitions that people had originally hoped for in Copenhagen. So I think people have said, oh, well, an empty agreement is worse than no agreement at all. But some kind of agreement, especially if it shows China beginning to cooperate with kind of an international regime of greenhouse gas reductions, that's going to create some momentum in the U.S. and I think probably internationally.
All right. Well, David Fahrenthold, thank you so much for being with us. David Fahrenthold is the environmental reporter for The Washington Post, and we appreciate your time this morning.
Thank you.
And we also had with us Lucia Green-Weiskopf, project manager at the Chinese Environmental Group, the Innovation Center for Energy and Transportation, and she joined us from Copenhagen. Thank you so much, Lucia.
Thanks for having me.
And coming up next, I'm Jamie Floyd in for Brian Lehrer. We will talk about the controversy over revising the diagnostic manual for mental illness. And we will be right back.